Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Hello and welcome to Lost in Science for another week. My name is Claire and sit back, wait for it. We have 30 minutes of some of the greatest science you're going to hear all week, I reckon. There, I've said it. And this week on the show, we have a couple of guests for you. First up, we have Saskia Gerhardy, who is currently doing her PhD on the Plains Wanderer. Those very elusive birds that hang out in grasslands. Now, Saskia has done some fascinating research, which is also incredibly hopeful. And some of the outcomes of that research suggest that what we understand about the Plains Wanderer being this sort of Goldilocks bird that can only live in a really narrow range and is incredibly critically endangered actually might not be as specialist as we thought when it comes to habitat. So Saskia and her team have discovered this whole other population of plains wanderers in South Australia, not living in grasslands at all, but living in spiky bushes. A really heartwarming conservation story, so stay tuned for that. And also on the show, speaking of conservation, we're stepping back into the archives this week to hear from animal reproductive biologist Dr. Jared McKenna when Chris had a chat to him back in 2022 about research planning to bring the thylacine or Tasmanian tiger back from extinction and back to Tasmania. Well, that was a couple of years ago when there was a big investment for the University of Melbourne to start a lab and get this thylacine research off the ground. And this week there has been another huge sum of money being given to the University of Melbourne by the US group Colossal, who tout themselves as the first de-extinction company, and who are leading the charge on de-extinction of the woolly mammoth. So a good time to revisit this story with Jared and Chris. All right, on with the show. One of Australia's rarest birds is the Plains Wanderer, which you may have heard of before, but chances are you haven't seen one in the wild. They are very shy and inhabit only a rapidly decreasing grassland area of Victoria and New South Wales. Or so we thought. This week, we're joined by PhD researcher Saskia Gerhardy from the University of Adelaide, who is leading incredibly hopeful and positive research, which has discovered a thriving population of the Plains Wanderers living in a pretty unexpected habitat. Saskia, welcome to Lost in Science.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, the Plains Wanderer, for people who might not have ever heard of it before, what makes the bird so special?
Yeah, they are a really special little bird. Most of all, because they are the sole remaining member of their family. So Plains Wanderers come from a really long lineage. The lineage is about 40 million years old. And at the moment, Plains Wanderers are the only sole remaining member of that family. So there quite literally isn't another bird on this planet like a Plains Wanderer. So Obviously really special and something that we want to conserve and look after into the future.
And what do they actually look like?
Yeah, well, they actually look a lot like quails. So people quite often mistake them for a quail. They are these short little ground-dwelling birds. They've got beautiful bright yellow legs. And they're kind of an unusual species. I guess when we think of most birds, we think of the showier bird being the male. You know, if you think of peacocks or birds of paradise, or I guess even like chickens, where in plains wanderers, it's kind of the opposite. So the female's the bigger bird, she's the showier bird. She's got this beautiful speckled collar. She's got a lovely little red patch on her upper chest. She's the one that does all the displaying and the calling. She's quite a, you know, quite a beautiful bird. And then by contrast, the male, he's a lot smaller. He's about half her size. And he's the one that does a lot of the egg rearing and the nest rearing and looks after the chicks. So, yeah, they can usually be told apart from other birds by their yellow bills and yellow legs, but otherwise, yeah, very similar to a quail.
Wow, so that's a bit of a gender role reverse to what you'd normally see in a bird.
For sure. It's a ladies' world out there in the plains wanderer
A
world.
plains
Yeah,
wanderer
I bet.
world.
Yeah, they're quite interesting like that. So it's yeah, the female will do all the breeding calls. She does this amazing display where she'll puff her neck up and drag her wings along the ground, and they'll make the nest together, and then the males bunker down and raise the chicks, and once she's laid that last egg, she'll go off and start the whole process again with another fella maybe a couple of kilometers away.
That's fascinating. I talked a bit in the intro that they have been described as grassland birds. What was the knowledge sort of like leading up to, I guess, your research that we understood about plains wanderers?
Plains wanderers are meant to be this super habitat specialist, so much so that they've earned themselves the nickname the Goldilocks bird. So they're sort of known as this species that likes their habitat to be sort of not too dense, not too sparse, just right. And it's sort of no mean feat to get just right for a plains wanderer. So historically, this was thought to be just grasslands, and it was all about the grass being no higher than 30 centimeters or no further apart than 10 centimeters, and 50% covering of the landscape. And it was this really specific makeup of habitat composition. I guess plains wanderers became associated with that type of grasslands, and these were just how we traditionally thought about plains wanderers as this real specialist that only lived in this really particular type of habitat.
And there's only a few of them left in the wild as well, right? So it was all about a race to protect that particular type of habitat.
Yeah, and I guess this sort of happens a lot when you have species that are specialists and rely so heavily on particular habitat types. When these habitats are modified or changed or maybe even ruined, then these species are then at risk. And this is sort of what's happened to plains wanderers, is that a lot of the habitat that these birds have used in the past has been changed a lot, and we don't see it in the same way. And as a result, these birds have declined quite dramatically. At the moment, our best guess is sort of about 2,000 birds, but they're quite responsive to rain and then drought. So this number does bounce around a little bit. But yeah, we sort of sit around 2,000 as our best guess.
Right. So let's talk about the research that you've just done. So how did you get started?
Yeah, so I work at a conservation reserve called Bulk Matter Station Reserve, which is managed by Bush Heritage Australia out in the South Australian Northeast Pastoral District. It's an area that had been identified as having plains wanderers on it sometimes. So it was sort of an area where maybe once every 5, 10 years there'd be this random sighting. Someone would take a photo and be like, "Is this a plains wanderer? I saw something that had yellow legs." There was all these kind of like these sort of random sightings that would get every so often. And myself and a team of researchers at Bush Heritage and at the University of Adelaide were sort of thinking, it'd be nice to know why they are sometimes here. And yeah, this is sort of where this project started. We just wanted to understand why this habitat was important, why these birds were sort of persistently showing up sometimes.
How did you get started? How did you set out to find these elusive plains wanderers in this new habitat?
Yeah, so like you say, in your intro, plains wanderers are an incredibly cryptic bird, really good at hiding. So finding them is sort of no mean feat, where we might normally go and do a bird survey when working with species like this. It's just not possible with a plains wanderer. They're way too good at camouflaging, way too reluctant to fly. So we needed to sort of rely on some specialist technologies. So one of the main ones we use is a thermal camera. And these are a really cool device. We set it up on the side of the car and use it almost like you use a spotlight in more traditional nocturnal surveys. And then basically just scanning the plains for little glowing dots in the night. And yeah, this is how we're able to start detecting our population of plains wanderers.
Right, so you obviously found some.
So we found our first one. I think we were all over the moon. I got out the car, I started crying. It was just, the most exciting night. But then we found another and
Wow.
another and another. And yeah, almost 3 years later, we've detected over 250 birds at that one reserve. So just
Wow.
been an absolute, like I say, I was surprised to find one. To find, hundreds is just, yeah, beyond my wildest dreams.
Wow. So that could be almost 10% of the entire population out there.
We can't help ourselves whenever we're doing the
Yeah.
surveys. Oh, well, tonight we saw, 0.5% or something like that. Yeah, it's hard to know for sure. Putting my science hat on, like, don't want to say, definitely, because we have changes in the numbers. We don't always have that 200 odd birds there. It's sort of, we might have 50 at one time, and the next season another 20 or so. And it is fluctuating. But yeah, I mean, before we started this project, it was predicted that the South Australian rangeland wouldn't host more than 10% of the population. And then to think that we've got almost that in one little conservation reserve really makes you think about their distribution and how many birds there might still be out there.
So you're using thermal cameras,
Thermals?
are you using GPS tracking as
Yeah.
well?
So once we found these birds, obviously it was just so exciting. We weren't expecting to find these birds at all. So this really opened up an opportunity to start trying to understand why these birds are there, what habitat they're using. And the best way to do that is through GPS technology. So we were able to use little GPS loggers and VHF devices and put them onto little backpacks for these birds,
Honestly,
which
birds
is
in backpacks is just the
birds in
cutest thing.
backpacks. Cutest thing. So yeah, they have these little rubber straps that go over their wings, and quite literally, like how we would wear a hiking backpack, they've got these little backpacks on, and they log where these birds are hanging out for the next month or so. And then by using that data, then we could get a better idea of the type of habitat that they were using, and sort of
Right.
understand what parts of the reserve are important for these birds.
Wow. And so you found that they were staying on the reserve in habitat that traditionally you wouldn't imagine they would be in.
Yeah, so like we was talking about before, these birds are really associated with grasslands and really specifically compositions of grasslands. But what we have at Bulk Matter is not grasslands. We have what is called like a low chenopod shrubland, which is sort of just a nice word for prickle bushes. So we just have just kilometers of prickle bushes out there that are sort of no higher than 10 or so centimeters. And then what we're able to find by tracking these birds is that they're actually using these small shrubby areas as habitat, and not actually using grasslands at all, which was, yeah, quite exciting when you think that, yeah, these birds are a little bit more adaptable than what we previously gave them credit for is a, yeah, really exciting thing.
So tell us about the next step. Is it going out and finding more prickly bush, getting the thermal camera out again?
Yeah, so this part of the project has just been one part of my PhD. So we're looking at quite a lot of other aspects with it. So what we've been able to do is collect DNA samples from these birds, but then also birds from Victoria and New South Wales, where they're more traditionally known to be. So the next step is to try and work out how these birds are related, whether they're sort of like migratory facet of the, or whether they've been isolated for a long time, and just try and understand how they fit into that big picture, which will be really exciting. We're also looking at doing some modelling, trying to understand where these birds might else be. So trying to sort of use computer and desktop devices to work out where this habitat might be found in other places around Australia. So then we can start to set up surveys, like you mentioned, in those areas. So we're sort of excited to see what comes next. It's one of those findings that I guess brings up more questions than answers.
You found 250 Plains Wanderers, was it?
Just over, yeah. I think the
Yeah.
official number was 272. Yeah.
272. Incredible. And did you find any little babies?
Yeah, so that was one of the more exciting parts of this project is that we were actually able to detect a number of nests and Plains Wanderer dads with their dependent chicks, which is obviously a really exciting finding when you have a threatened species that's breeding. Yeah, it just brings a lot of hope and Yeah, optimism for the future. But I guess for us as well, when you see that these birds are happily breeding in these areas, it sort of shows you that this habitat is good for them, and it's something that they're comfortable in, and they're able to bring about enough resources to bring out chicks. So a really encouraging finding, and something that's been, a really exciting part of this project.
Well, Saskia, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your work, and for reminding us that nature does surprises when we give it a chance, and even when it's, at its most critically endangered. Best of luck for the next steps in your PhD, and can't wait to hear more about those Little Plains Wanderers.
Thanks so much for having me. It was great to come and join you.
In the history of science, novel and innovative concepts occasionally arise from sudden left-field inspiration.
Nothing shocks me. I'm a scientist.
But I'd rather be remembered for my own small contributions to science.
As a scientist, I don't want to prejudice my experiment. I'll let you know in the morning.
I am a scientist!
I think they're scientists.
I bring scientists. You bring a rock star.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, you are listening to Lost in Science.
All right, you are listening to Lost in Science. My name is Chris, and I have with me on the line Jared McKenna, who is a reproductive biologist and the person to talk to about all things to do with, I guess, assisted reproduction and animal conservation, and very appropriate to the question of bringing thylacines back from extinction. Jared, thank you for joining us once again on Lost in Science.
Not a problem. Thanks for having me again.
Tell us, what is this project about, and how do you bring an extinct creature like the thylacine or Tasmanian tiger back to life?
Big questions, an even bigger project. It's one that you can't not think of Jurassic Park. It really pulls on the sort of nostalgia strings, doesn't it? Trying to bring back something from extinction. We've all seen Jurassic Park. We all love it, and we all like the idea of bringing back something that we did love at a point, even if it was a dinosaur, even if it is feasible or not. We all love the idea of it. It's a very steeped in our sort of pop culture, but it's a very, very, very tricky thing to do scientifically. So Jurassic Park did get a couple of things right. They got a couple of things wrong. Besides the whole dinosaurs went a little bit crazy at the end, they got most of the science right. And most of that science is exactly what we're going to be doing to try and bring back thylacine. So the way that they plan to do this, they've got a whole bunch of steps that they need to go through. And the first is to actually get thylacine DNA. They've got to get Tassie tiger DNA to know what a Tassie tiger looks like genetically. And that was the first hurdle. But thankfully, they've already overcome that. So they've had a lot of preserved specimens over the years from zoos and conservation organizations that they've been able to get lots of tissue from. So thankfully, we've got essentially their whole genome sequence, which is a big tick and a big step forward already. The next step is that they had to sequence the DNA of a very similar species. So in this case for the Tassie tiger, it was the a numbat or a fat-tailed dunnart, and they've done that as well. So why did they do that? Well, they need to compare the DNA that they've got from the thylacine against a similar species to see how they could sort of tweak it to make a thylacine again. So while we do have the DNA from the dead animals, we do need some fresh DNA. So you can use the old DNA as a template and then compare that to a similar species and then try and fill in the gaps to make the new species. So those are the first two steps that they've sort of done, and there's a couple more to go yet.
Okay, so it's not directly just like cloning a creature from, say, getting a cell from an extinct Tasmanian tiger and cloning that, or even just inserting its DNA whole into an embryo of another species.
It's a little bit more complicated than that, because it really depends how long the animals or the cells have been dead for or frozen for. So we actually can and have done it with frozen mice tissue. They've frozen some mouse tissue for about 20 years or 15 years, I think it was, and cloned that mouse, and it worked pretty well. But that was because that DNA was preserved correctly. And the problem with a lot of the animals that we want to bring back from extinction, we didn't exactly plan very well. So that DNA has fragmented and it's damaged, and it's very, very hard to sort of pick up the pieces and put it all together into another cell. So if you imagine the DNA is a book, and then that book has gone through the shredder and you're trying to assemble that book again. All the pieces are there, but it's very, very, very difficult to put it back together unless you know exactly the position of each of those little fragments.
Does this mean what you end up with is not an exact copy of a thylacine because you have kind of cobbled it together out of the remnant bits plus the DNA of a related species?
Pretty much, yeah. That's why we're sort of going with a similar species to sort of fill in the gaps on what we think the thylacine DNA would look like. So if we were to go with that, take the thylacine DNA, put it into another cell, and then let that cell grow into a thylacine, that would be a clone. This is almost a clone. We're creating what we think is a thylacine, and that's the subjectivity already, because it's what we think it is. It probably will never be what it exactly was. Whether that's good, whether that's a bad thing, time will tell.
Once you've got that, though, the DNA, and presumably you have, used your numbat or fat-tailed dunnart, do you put it back into the dunnart to gestate and bring it to birth, I guess?
So the next step after that is, we've got the DNA in the cell, and now we've got the thylacine embryo. Yeah, what do we do with it? Because there's no thylacine mother to put it back into and then gestate and hold that pregnancy. So we go again to a similar species. So that would most likely be a Tassie devil. It could be a numbat, could be a fat-tailed dunnart, probably the Tassie devil just because of size. It's a little bit bigger. But the beautiful thing about marsupials is that size may not be that big of an issue because they actually give birth to very, very underdeveloped young anyway. So there would really be only a couple of days, a couple of weeks before the animal would actually give birth. So it might not be such a big issue. But yes, picking which species to be the surrogate mother is still up for debate, I think.
What do you see as the main challenges with getting this to work?
Well, science in its all its wonder is incredibly difficult and incredibly specific, especially with genetics. So, for example, if we have a technique like IVF that's defined in humans, if we want to do that in gorillas, it could be very similar, but it will require some sort of tweaking. And a lot of the techniques that we're trying to define with thylacine are from scratch. So that is a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of research to sort of get those really fundamental techniques off the ground. And then once we've got those fundamental ones, then we need to get to the quite specific ones that are even more technical to sort of get off the ground. So there's quite a lot of technical hurdles still to go. So after we sort of make that thylacine DNA or what we think it would be, and then we put it into a cell, we need to make sure that that cell is actually going to live and grow and that DNA is going to be replicated correctly. We need to make sure that those cells are able to actually be totipotent, which means, they can make every other cell in the body. So there's a lot of technical hurdles still to go. And then that's not to mention if we do actually get a thylacine baby at the end of all of this, which would be tremendous for science, that's one. What good is one?
Yeah.
There's a lot of estimates out there on how many animals we need for a population to be viable, and they vary between 500 to a couple of thousand. And that depends on the species. If you look at a rabbit, for example, they breed extremely quickly. They've got like litters of 12 or 10 or something like that. But also everybody eats them. So they reproduce very quickly, but then they also get eaten quite a lot. So they might need 500 animals initially, and then that might teeter off as animals start to eat them. Or if you look at animals that breed very inefficiently, so animals that give birth once a year, for example, you're going to need a lot more animals for that population to be reproductively fit, we say. So it's going to prevent inbreeding and sort of those negative effects that we see with small populations. So if we've got one, that's great, but we probably need about 1,000 okay. For it to be properly useful for the species.
If we were to create another one, if we're using the same donor source, then you're going to have the genetically the same seed. We need to have lots of different thylacine samples.
Exactly, yeah. So we do have, a handful of really good copies, which are founding a lot of this understanding about the DNA to begin with. We need 500 or 1,000 animals. So do we artificially introduce some of that sort of natural variation that you would get in the wild? We probably can. CRISPR is a very, very powerful technique now, and it's going to underpin a lot of this DNA work that the researchers are doing. But then it sort of brings in the whole moral ethical side again, you know, what are we creating? Introducing good genes, and are we introducing bad genes? And is introducing a bad gene necessarily bad? We don't really know, because that's what nature does sometimes. You know, bad genes make their way in, and that's a natural thing. We can't edit only good genes in, and it's a very tricky one to sort of artificially manage.
I guess, look, the big question obviously I want to ask is then, is this going to work?
Yeah, I'd like to be optimistic, because I'm very positive about how quickly science can move when it's well-funded and well-motivated and well-supported. So I'm optimistic that this could work, but like you said, it could take a long, long time to get where we want and to get enough animals and enough genetically diverse animals, because even if we do get to those 1,000 species for, say, you know, we don't even know if they're going to be useful. And if we are to sort of, you know, pop them on a plane and drop them back at Tassie, we don't know if they're actually going to refill that niche that they did occupy. But yeah, you do have to question the time frame to actually get this ball rolling and get all of those animals made and in the wild again. You know, it could take decades. And is that time and effort and money better spent elsewhere? You know, it's sort of the question. You relate it back to climate change. You know, it's well and good, you know, funding things like carbon capture, capturing all the carbon dioxide that we're producing, but it's not stopping us producing the carbon dioxide. And it's a similar debate. You know, we can de-extinct animals and put them back, but if we put them back, are they just going to go extinct again? Is it better to put all that time, money, and all those resources to preventing other animals from going extinct rather than bringing back one? That's a big debate, and it's sort of a big point in the team no for bringing back thylacine. It's probably the biggest conflicting point, and I think it's a very valid one. And again, hard decisions, because if somebody is willing to fund it, then you can't really say no. If somebody has given you the money to do it, then by all means do it. But I would personally prefer that money to be spent elsewhere, stopping the other animals from going extinct instead.
Well, thanks very much, Jad. It will be very interesting to see how this works out.
Yes, stay tuned.
And that's all we have time for on another episode of Lost in Science. Thanks for listening. Lost in Science is recorded on the lands of the Kulin Nations and the Ngunnawal people, and broadcast across Australia on the Community Radio Network with the kind support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. If you would like to get in touch with us, we would love to hear from you. You can drop us a line at lostinsci@gmail.com. You can find us on Facebook, where we are Lost in Science on 3CR. Or you can just tune in wherever you find us, on your radio, on your podcast, next week when Chris, Stu, Lyndon and Claire get Lost in Science.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online.